Again, this is Bob Brundage again, and the date today is May the 17th, 2008. And today we're very, very happy to have a chance to talk finally with Mr. Ed Foote back in Wexford, Pennsylvania. And Ed is going to be another first to all of his firsts that he's had over his career, because this is the first caller that I've talked with that works almost exclusively in the challenge area of square dancing. So, Ed, why don't you give us a little background before square dancing and tell us where you were brought up and what life was like before square dancing.
Well, I was born and raised in Pittsburgh and went to college, got a BA degree at Lafayette College in eastern Pennsylvania, and then got an MBA degree from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and was part of the Army National Guard for 6 years. I worked for, and during that time I worked for 3 years for Mellon Bank in their operations division and 4 years in Columbia Gas in their rate division. And when Columbia Gas left Pittsburgh in 1973, I went full-time. I should make one comment here initially on your opening statement. I have never worked exclusively with Challenge. My entire career of 43 years in calling, 50% of all of my calling has always been mainstream or plus.
I see.
Some people think that I work exclusively with Challenge because that's where my name has been publicized a lot. I was chairman of the Challenge Committee in Colorado for 30 years. I ran the National Advance and Challenge Square Dance Convention for 34 years. I've written a lot of Challenge articles for about 20 years. I wrote a monthly column for American Square Dance Magazine that my instructions were to keep it at Advance and Challenge News because they had enough information from other people on other topics. It was only about 5 years ago when new owners took over that I was allowed to write anything I wanted in that column. So I, and one of my clubs, North Hills Squares, I've been the regular caller there for 40 years this year. And it's always been a plus club. And I call numerous mainstream and plus dances every year. And like I say, 50% of all my calling every year is always mainstream and plus.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I didn't mean to imply that you were exclusive, but be that as it may. Well, you covered everything in general, and we'd like to get a little more comprehensive than that if we can. How did you get introduced to square dancing in the first place?
Well, I got introduced in square dancing. I was working at Bloomingdale's department store in New York City in the summer of 1964 between years at graduate school at Wharton School. And I was staying in a dorm at Columbia University, and every Friday night at the student union, they had a dance, and so I would go there every Friday night and dance, and it was the traditional type of dancing where you didn't have to know anything, and they taught you everything
right
that you learned.
Well, that's interesting. Who were some of your mentors as you came along?
The mentors in terms of calling, I didn't really have any in dancing, so to speak. I was really was all in calling. The first one was Pete Heckman from Pittsburgh, who was a long time, for many years he was the most difficult caller in the United States. He specialized in challenge. Of course, it wasn't called challenge then, back in the 50s and
right.
60s. It was called hot hash. And, for instance, the well-known caller Lee Kopman, who has specialized in challenge, he listened to Pete Heckman's tapes for years as he was learning to call. Well, Pete Heckman was in Pittsburgh, and so I attended his dances before I started to call, and that's where, and then once I started to call, he would let me practice calling for his group. Other callers that had an influence on me were Lee Kottman, because I attended his dances when I was first learning to dance, Western in the first 4 months or so. I was going to his challenge dances, and once I started to call, he would let me call a tip at his dances. And then after I'd been calling for about a year, Jack Lazary was a big help. I would listen to his tapes and try to imitate some of his phrases. In fact, some people for a long time said that my calling reminded them of Jack Lazary because of some of the phrases that I would use.
Right.
So those were the three main callers that had an influence on me.
Right. Well, going back just a second, when you were at Columbia, is that where you met Marilyn or your wife?
No, I met Marilyn in 1967 when I was working at Mellon Bank, and as part of their management training program, I would rotate through all the different parts of branches of the bank, all different parts of the bank.
Yeah.
And she was working in one of the parts of the bank, and that's where I met her there.
Right. So, and she's your devoted partner, I understand.
Right. We got married in 1968, and she learned to square dance once we got together. She didn't know how to square dance before that, and so I taught her how to square dance and been square dancing ever since.
Right, right. Well, I know she's been very helpful with you, too. We'll talk about the National Advance and Challenge Convention in a minute. Let's first of all talk about your association with Caller Lab.
Oh, okay. Well, my association with Caller Lab, my first convention was in 1975 in Chicago, and I've been to every convention except one since then. I was chairman of the challenge committee when the first committee was appointed in 1977. It was called the Advance and Challenge Committee, and I was chairman of that. Then in 1983, that committee was divided into two parts, the Advance Committee and Challenge Committee. So I remained chairman of the Challenge Committee, and then the Advance Committee being a separate committee, there was a separate chairman for that. In addition, in Caller Lab, I wrote the procedure for ethics complaints for callers, and I based it really on legal principles. I've had a long time interest in the study of law, so I wrote up the ethics procedure for filing a complaint based on that, and that procedure is basically still the one in use today. Fortunately, the procedure has only had to be used maybe three or four times in the history of Caller Lab, because the ethics committee chairman and the chairman of Caller Lab are able to resolve disputes before it gets that far to what we would call adjudication. In addition, I recommended the Caller Lab emphasis call program, where one call is emphasized for 3 months or 6 months, and that's been done at Mainstream and Plus and Advance.
Right.
And I recommended that back, I forget when, probably the early 80s, and that program still is in effect today.
Right. Well, you were also on the Board of Governors.
I was on the Board of Governors for 3 years, right.
Right. And several other committees, too.
Yes, I've been on the Advance Committee for as long as it's been in effect, and the Ethics Committee, and I'm trying to remember. Well, the right now I'm on the ARC Committee, which reviews different choreography questions that are sent in and whether they're appropriate or not. I've been on the Ethics Committee. I was on the Program Policy Committee for a number of years, which look to coordinate Caller Lab programs with the overall goals and aims of Caller Lab.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of any other. That's probably most of the...
Yes.
Well, I've been on the Mainstream Committee and the Plus Committee, and been on them for a number of years as a member.
Well, that's certainly an interesting bio. Let's see, you've also done a lot with caller training. And I know you've done... Oh, I wanted to ask you, first of all, before, if you... had you done any recording, per se, like Square Dance Records? I don't remember that...
Well, my only Square Dance record was one tip on one of Bob Osgood's record albums that he made for a number of years featuring a different...
promotional record.
Promotional record, and he'd have about 10 callers on each year's album. My main recording was making teach tapes for Advanced and Challenge. I started that in the early 80s, and these were for tape groups, people who didn't have callers in their area that were calling Advanced or Challenge but wanted to learn it. They would learn from tape, from teach tapes. And there were two or three callers that had made teach tapes before mine, and but I decided to make a set, and they proved very popular. I also sold dance tapes, again, for mainly for tape groups, at all levels, primarily Advance and Challenge. There was no real need to make these for Mainstream Plus, since there were plenty of callers calling that.
Right.
I did make tapes for Mainstream Plus at DBD, or Dance by Definition, or All Position Dancing, teach tapes for teaching people that already knew how to dance Mainstream Plus. These tapes would show them how to dance these calls from all a different variety of positions.
Right.
And then dance tapes for that also. And then about 10 years ago, I made a mainstream video teach tape, again, teaching people that already knew the mainstream calls from one or two positions how to understand the mainstream calls from a variety of positions.
I see. Well, that's interesting. Well, then, you've also had, like, caller schools and clinics and like that.
Yes, I've done caller schools in, I think it's 38 states and a number of countries in Europe. Done them in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. For a number of years, I ran a school here at my home, a five-day school every summer for about 17 years here at home.
Uh-huh. Well, which brings up your travels overseas, and so I know you've done extensive traveling, and besides the callers' clinics, you're also calling for various clubs and so forth right around the world.
Yes, I started going overseas for calling back in the middle 80s, and I've made a total of, it's either 18 or 19 trips overseas. About 11 of them have been to England. I've called in 10 European countries plus Australia and New Zealand, called about 5 times in Sweden. And when I would make my trips over there, most callers would go over for a weekend and just go call for a weekend, come back. I wouldn't do that. My wife and I would go and maybe make a 3-week trip out of it, and we would sightsee and call. And the first time I would go to a country would be for sightseeing with any calling I could get. Then when I would go back, it would be as a business operation, and I would fly back and call for looking at it as a business. And again, I would make my trips 2 and 3 weeks. So I would call for a variety of clubs, and probably the vast majority of them were mainstream and plus clubs.
Right.
And in fact, the majority of them would be mainstream clubs, because back in the 80s and 90s, most of the clubs in Europe were mainstream. But I did call for challenge groups over there also, and advanced groups, and help promote that,
right,
those programs over there.
Yes. I have to interject here. I think you said, you made a comment that the European dancers are much better than U.S. dancers.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So,
there's a reason for that, if you want to...
Yes, I'd like to hear that.
The reason is, and this, I first discovered this, the whole history of how this happened is interesting. When I first went overseas to England in the beginning of the 80s, the level of dancing there, the ability of the dancers were the same as here. There was no difference. When I went to Sweden in 1985, the Swedish dancers dancing in Sweden started in the early 80s. At the beginning of the 1980s, there was only one club in Sweden. That was in Stockholm. A couple dancers from who had danced in Sweden, or excuse me, they hadn't danced in Sweden. A couple people from Sweden went to Saudi Arabia and danced in and were part of Aramco, the oil company there. And they were pretty much confined to their base because of the Arab customs. They really didn't want to leave the base much. So they started square dancing as a means to pass the time, and they would get tapes and records. Well, when these people went back to Stockholm, they said, well, let's start a square dance group in Sweden. They went back and started and self-taught. They taught the people just from what they knew, and this snowballed. And by the time I first went to Sweden in 1985, from one club in Stockholm in 81, there were now about 35 to 40 clubs throughout Sweden, all having spun off from this original three or four people that went to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Well, those people then quickly, and they were dancing better than the U.S., and then those people quickly decided they wanted to travel, so they went to festivals in Germany and Denmark, and they could outdance the people in Germany and Denmark. Well, the people in Germany and Denmark didn't want to be outdone, so they said, well, we better learn to dance as good as the Swedes. And boom, in the space of 5 to 7 years, Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, England, they were all dancing at this much higher level. People ask, well, why do people in Europe dance much better and dance the calls much better than in the U.S.? And the answer is it's because of the mindset. In Europe, people say, we want to have fun. And the way to have fun at square dancing is to totally know and understand the calls. Because if we totally know and understand the calls, we won't break down. And fun is not breaking down, so we're going to study the calls and know them inside out, and then we won't break down and we'll have fun. In the United States, the dancers say, we want to have fun. And fun means doing the least amount of work possible. So we want to learn only the bare minimum to be able to get by, and then that's all we want to do, because fun means not having to work. So that's why the people in Europe learn to dance DBD and all position dancing in their beginner's class right from the get-go, where in the United States, probably the majority of dancers never get exposed to all position dancing and have really no interest in doing so.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. I'm glad you expounded on that. Some of these countries, you've been to Japan and China?
No, haven't been to Japan or China. A number of other callers have been to Japan and China.
Yes.
My only trips to Asia have been two trips to Australia and one to New Zealand. I did a number of caller schools over there, caller clinics and seminars, as well as calling throughout the whole east coast of Australia, from Queensland all the way down to Melbourne. And in New Zealand, we were there for a month, 2 weeks on the North Island, 2 weeks on the South Island, and had just a lot of dances on both islands.
Right. Now, the reason I asked that, I wondered if you had any thoughts on calling for non-English speaking dancers.
Well, my only real experience with that was when I first started to go to Germany, which was in the late 80s, and all the young people could speak English, so that was no problem. The older people probably didn't have English in school, so they couldn't speak it. So when I first started to call in Germany, I wanted to know what percentage of the floor understood English, because if most of them didn't, then it would do me no good to directional cue calls.
Right.
Everybody knew the calls in English, but if I directional cued something, they didn't understand the directional cueing, then it wasn't worth my while doing that. So what I would do would be, at the very start of the dance, I would inject a 10-second quick joke comment, and I would look and see what percent of the floor laughed.
Right.
And that would tell me what percent of the floor understood English. Now, by the mid-90s, virtually everybody understood English. From the get-go in Sweden, you can walk down the street and talk to everybody in English because they always got English television from across the North Sea. There was no interference in the television signal. So everybody has grown up in Sweden with English. In Germany, it's a little bit different, but ever since the mid-90s, you can talk to most people on the streets in English, and you'll be able to carry on a conversation with them. So I've never had the experience that callers have in, say, Japan, where people literally know no English,
right,
except the square dance commands.
Yes.
I know one time, for a number of years, at the Advance and Challenge Convention, there would be 8 or 9 women from Japan would come to our convention, and almost none of them could speak English. They could do the calls. They were dancing C3, but they couldn't speak. They couldn't carry on a conversation. And one woman who could understand English, she was a spokesperson for everyone, and she would go up to Maryland, pay everybody's fees, and ask all the questions, and because none of the others could speak English.
Right. Well, did you bump into Al Stevens in Germany?
No, I first called with Al Stevens in 1976 at the Yorktown Square Dance Festival in Yorktown, Virginia, and that was before he went to Europe.
Right.
And he and I got along great, and we had a great time, and then he went over, and that was the only time I ever saw him at a square dance. I've seen him a number of years since at Caller Lab, but I never ran into him in Europe.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Well, let's talk about the National Advanced and Challenge Convention. I know you were the one that organized it. You and Marilyn did all the work, for heaven's sake, for years.
That's true. It was started because the National Convention refused to provide halls for dancers who had studied Advance and Challenge, even though it wasn't called that back then, just a place to have better dancing. They refused to provide a hall for that.
Right.
So I said that wasn't fair, so we organized in 1967 as part of the National, well, it wasn't part of the National Convention was in Philadelphia, and at the George Washington Motor Lodge in Valley Forge, I set up after parties that ran from 11 at night to 1 in the morning of challenge, and that was really where the word challenge first started to come into effect. And I got about 6 or 8 callers to volunteer to call there. And that was the start of the challenge convention. And then the following year, 1968, we decided to make it a separate event. Now it's held in Columbus, Ohio, and it was a separate event ever from then on. We added an advanced hall, I think it was 1984. We added an advanced hall, and the convention started out as one hall, and eventually it went to 2 halls, and then it went to 3, 4. When it finally, at its heyday, we were dancing 6 halls. We were dancing A2, C1, C2, C3A, C3B, 5 halls full-time, and then a C4 hall part-time. And it operated that in that manner for, starting in the mid-90s, or early 90s, until the convention ended. The last year of the convention was the year 2000.
Right. Well, you very kindly sent me a copy of the program for the Challenge Convention in 2000, which contained a very nice history of not only the convention, but also of challenge dancing. In there, I noticed one comment that I thought very interesting, and that is that it started out as challenge and eventually evolved into advanced and challenge because some of the dancers thought the challenge level was a little too much and they wanted something a little lower level than that.
Right. Back in the mid-70s, there were no lists for any call.
Right.
And so those of us who were involved with Challenge said we need some kind of unified list. So I took a poll of all the leading Challenge callers at the time and then published in 1973, it was really the start of 74, the first list of challenge calls that was agreed upon by everyone, and that was called the Challenge Dancing's Basic 100 Calls List. Well, about 6 months later, some people said, well, we want to do more than what's being called at regular club dances, but we don't want to do these 100 calls. What are the 50 most common calls? So I took the poll of the callers again. We came up with a list for advanced, the advanced dancing list. We decided we would do this poll every 2 years, so in 1976 we did the whole thing again. I canvassed all the callers. This time we dropped the name of 100, the Challenge Basic 100 call list, because we recognized it could be more or less than 100 calls. And in 1976 published the second advanced dancing's basic list and challenge dancing's basic list. In 1977, Caller Lab took over the programs, and then these lists were started being published under the Caller Lab auspices. So we had a new vote in 1977 of the callers that were in Caller Lab that were calling Advance and Challenge, and went from there.
Right. Well, I know your convention has been up and down in attendance, but I noticed that you, 1 year at least, had 200 squares.
Right. The height of it was 200 squares. I think that was 1992, somewhere around there. That was in Virginia Beach. We were in Virginia Beach for about 10 of our total of 34 years. And the reason the convention folded after the year 2000 was that the downturn in square dancing in general and all events were downsizing. And by the year 2000, there were numerous challenge weekends throughout the year, and our event had started to decline in attendance. And with running six halls, it's pretty difficult to find a place where you could afford six halls.
Right.
And we were in a hotel to try to get enough room nights to pay for the hall, and it just was a struggle for the last 3 or 4 years to be able to meet expenses. So I decided after year 2000 to just end the convention. And for those who wanted to continue to dance, there were numerous weekends, almost every weekend of the year there would be a challenge weekend somewhere that they could go dance.
Right. Well, I know here in Albuquerque, someone promoted what they call a fly-in. Is that
fly-ins are from that's what the Gay and Lesbian Association of Square Dancers call their weekends, and
weekends
are fly-ins.
Okay.
They're usually at multi-levels. They'll have basic and mainstream and plus and advance and challenge throughout the whole weekend.
Right.
So every gay square dance event is called a fly-in, except for their international convention, and that's called the International Gay and Square Dance. Gay and Lesbian Square Dance Convention.
Right, right. Well, could you tell us a little bit more about the different levels? Now, how many, I don't know if it really is that important, but how many calls would be in C1 and then C2 and so forth?
Well, when we talk about levels, of course, Caller Lab prefers us to use the term program, so
right.
We don't say that a person is a certain level and therefore they're better than someone else.
Yeah.
So there are nine programs altogether. Seven of them are recognized by Caller Lab. So starting from the bottom, it would be basic, then mainstream, then plus, then advanced, and there's A1 and A2 within advanced. So
right.
You might say there's two programs there, one, but let's just say it's one. So advanced would be level number four, and then there's C1, C2, C3A, and C3B, and that's because there's A and B, because at one time there was only one C3 list, but there wound up being so many calls on there, the dancer said, we better split these up. We got too much to know, too much to learn. So we split them to A and B. And then, so that's, I'm trying to think, if level 5 was C1, C2, C3A, C3B, that would be 8. And then C4 is 9. Caller Lab recognizes through C3A, and the challenge committee at Caller Lab is responsible for all the lists of calls through C3A. The lists of calls at C3B and C4 are handled privately. A caller is selected to canvass all the callers calling those programs, and those lists are made from there. In terms of the number of calls at each program, we know that Mainstream has about 68. When you count through Plus, that's about 100. So if a person is dancing the Plus program, I generally say they know about 100 calls.
Right.
Advanced consists of 75 calls. C1, C2, and C3A and C3B each have about 100 calls.
Uh-huh.
So somebody dancing A2 will know 175 calls. Dancing C1 will know 375.
Yeah.
And C2 will know 475. Of course, there's the difference between Advanced and Challenge and Mainstream and Plus is twofold. One is the number of calls, the quantity of calls, but then two is the complexity of calls. How difficult are these calls?
Right.
And those are the two components that make up each of the programs as we move along the line.
Right. Well, anything else about the convention you want to tell us about before we move on?
No, that's pretty much it. I enjoyed all the years doing it, and we had our convention in, like I said, for 10 years in Virginia Beach. We were in Dayton, Ohio 2 years, and Louisville, Kentucky for 2 years. In the early years of the convention, we were in Pittsburgh for about 5 years, but that was when the convention only was two halls. We were in Niagara Falls 1 year. Our last year was in Milwaukee. So it was a good learning experience for me because I, in essence, was a meeting planner for 34 years and had to deal with convention and visitors bureaus around the country trying to find a place for our convention. And so I really enjoyed the experience with that.
All right. Well, I mean, you certainly have to be complimented, you and Marilyn, because, good heavens, you know, when you put on the other regular national convention, it takes committee after committee and hundreds of people, and you and Marilyn did most of the work yourselves.
Well, I've always felt that the national convention staff running it is bloated. There are way too many people there than there need to be. I mean, in our convention, granted, it was myself and Marilyn doing the bulk of the work. Besides us, we had a sound person and a person doing the scheduling of the callers.
Right.
And that was it, four people.
Yeah.
So at the height of the convention, we had 200 squares. That was 1,600 dancers. The national convention is really just more people, but in terms of what has to be done, there isn't really a whole lot more that has to be done.
That's true.
When you have 20,000 dancers and when you have 1,600, you just increase the quantities. So I've always felt that the big national could easily be run with 40 people.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it takes a lot of work and a lot of time, and a lot of people don't have the time and hours to give. So
right. If
people only have a couple hours to give, then it takes more quantity to equal the number of hours, say, that Marilyn and myself put into running our convention.
Right. Do you ever get a chance to dance yourself?
Occasionally, when we have guest callers at my home clubs here in Pittsburgh, which mainly we have guest callers when I'm on the road, but
yes.
Two or three times a year, we'll have a caller that says he's coming through Pittsburgh, and I'll just give up my night for him.
Yeah.
And so then we'll dance in that manner. It was interesting with the National Challenge Convention. One of the reasons I started it was so that I would have a place to dance challenge, and the result quickly was that I couldn't dance at my own convention because I was too busy running it, and I would be lucky to get 45 minutes of dancing in during a 3-day period.
Right, right. Well, I know you've also been staff caller at many other festivals around the country and around the world.
Yeah, I sent you a list of all those. I don't know how many are on there, but I've called festivals in more than half the United States and overseas.
Okay. I'd like to ask you, what do you find appealing about calling? What do you find is the appeal to you?
The appeal to me is providing fun for the dancers. And the one word that describes what I'm trying to convey to the dancers is inspiration. I want them to be inspired. So I try to select music that will get that will lift them off their feet. When I first started dancing to a caller named Paul Hunt,
right,
on Long Island back in 1966, his style of calling had you feeling like you were on a little platform of air 2 inches off the ground.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the way I've wanted to make the dancers feel, but I also wanted them to feel inspired by the music. So that's the way I call, and I make my patter calling that way, and I just want to uplift the floor in that manner. As a result of that philosophy, which may or may not be the philosophy of other callers, some callers have the philosophy, I'm going to call to the lowest level square on the floor, and that'll get everybody through. And that's fine. There's a number of callers that have that philosophy. That's never been my philosophy. My philosophy is I don't want to penalize the dancers that know what they're doing because some dancers on the floor don't know what they're doing.
Yes.
So my goal has always been to pull the bottom 10% up to the level of the other 90%.
Right.
So if I have, if there's 20 squares on the floor and two are standing, I'm not going to be too concerned about that. I'm going to try to directional call to get those two squares dancing along, but I'm really calling to the 90% of the floor that can handle it.
Right. Well, that's really great. So, do you do any round dancing at all?
I can round dance. I can do phase two rounds, and I am a round dance cueer.
Yeah.
I can cue about 20 rounds, but I never hire myself out as a cueer per se, because
right,
I did that once or twice and I found I never left the stage. I never could talk to the dancers. I'd call the dance and I'd call the rounds. And so I just prefer not to hire myself out that way. But at my home club, when our regular cueer is away a couple times a year, then I'll cue there. And if a club gets stuck that I'm cueing for or that I'm calling for, and well, our cueer didn't show up, then I can step in and I have enough rounds to handle one evening's program.
Right. Looking over your resume, I see you've done considerable writing for square dancing, too. Tell us about that.
I started writing back in one of the first times was when I started writing for the News and Notes. That was the title, News and Notes Caller Notes Service.
Right.
That had been established by Al Brundage and Earl Johnson.
Right.
And they asked Deuce Williams to be a writer for that service, but he wasn't able to do all of the issues. Al basically did the office work for the issues. Earl Johnson wrote one page of record review,
right,
and then Deuce Williams would do all the choreography.
Right.
And so he would write 90% of the issue. Well, he found he didn't have the time to do all that, so they asked me to come on board, and Deuce and I split six issues. We each did six issues a year, and then that was in 1978. Deuce fairly quickly then kind of backed off and didn't really want to do too much, and so by 1982 I was the full-time writer for News and Notes. And then in 1987 or along in there, Al and Earl decided they wanted to not be involved with the note service anymore, so they sold it to me, and I took it over and ran it. I guess I stopped writing the end of 1989 or early 1990. I just phased out of the note service. I was very disappointed because a lot of the top callers in the country said it was the best note service around. I always considered the best note service was Jack Lazary, and I patterned my writing after his.
Yes.
But he passed away in the mid-80s, and so once he passed away, a number of callers said they thought mine had the most interesting choreography. It explained it well and everything. But if I wanted to raise my note service the price of $1, I would lose all sorts of subscriptions.
Right.
It's like people were looking at the dollar amount. They weren't looking at the quality. And so I quickly found that I wasn't able to generate enough money from the note service to cover all the time that I was putting in writing this. And this was a 10-page note service every month, so it took a lot of time.
Sure.
So I just decided to back off and not do it anymore, which was disappointing. I enjoyed writing that, and I still have all the back issues of my note service, and in fact I have all the back issues of Lazary's note service.
Yes.
But I enjoyed doing that during that time. Then I also, American Square Dance magazine asked me to write a monthly column on Advance and Challenge starting in 1984, which I did every month for 20 years, and then I think it was 2003 when the current owners took over. They said, you can now write on anything you want. You don't have to limit it to Advance and Challenge.
Yes.
So now I've been basically ignoring Advance and Challenge in my articles and just writing on all topics. I've also I also wrote the psych calling write-ups that Caller Lab uses for psych calling and hands out and all its psych calling seminars and that kind of thing on isolated sight, two-face line sight, and facing line sight. And then the fourth article is how to remember your partner and how to remember your primary and secondary couples in three squares. Those four articles are part of the Caller Lab curriculum that's handed out with all of their handouts for their psych calling handouts. Then in addition, I've written a lot of articles that I wrote in American Square Dance magazine. I would reprint and then just put out at dances. The ones that I've used for over 20 years are ones called Tips for New Dancers, another one Tips for Better Dancing, and the third one How to Look Good When You're Dancing. And I've literally handed out maybe 10 to 20,000 copies of those three articles.
Yes.
Just at every dance I go to and in Europe. And a lot of people say, can we reprint these? And I say, fine, no problem. So these articles have been reprinted in a number of booklets. I also currently write for the Northeast Dancer magazine, which serves New England. And I've been writing for them for, I think, 15 years, something like that. Those are the two publications I write for. For about 2 years I wrote for the Promenade magazine, which serves Seattle, and wrote for them for 2 years until new owners took over. But so my basic writing is now for American Square Dance magazine, Northeast Dancer, and then the articles that I pass out at my dances and at caller clinics and caller schools.
Right. Let me interrupt you for a second and turn this tape over. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay, we're back, and we were talking about your writing. You've also written some books.
No, I've not written any square dance books per se. They've all been articles.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I'll amend that. The one book I wrote was entitled "How to Run a Successful Advanced and Challenge Tape Group," I wrote this in 1979. And sold this for about 10 years. People that run tape groups, a lot of people say, well, let's start a tape group, but they have no idea how to run it. So I took all the best ideas from tape groups all around the country, put it all in a book, and sold that. And that's the only book that I've actually written. Now, I've been co-author on some other books. started off with a person who wrote diagram books for advanced C1 and C2 back at the beginning of the 80s, a person named Milt Strong, and he had me be the editor for that book. And then when he went out of business in the mid-80s, a lady named Ruth Grazer in California took over the books, and she wrote all of the calls and diagrammed them all and for all the different programs. We had one for Mainstream and Plus and Advanced C1, C2, and C3A. She would write the book, but I would proofread it and make sure all the wording was correct and the diagrams were correct. And so we each did, she did the bulk of the work by putting all these on the computer, which took a lot of time.
Yeah.
But then I was the editor for it because each book would require probably 8 or 9 edits before it was ready to go into print. And we sold just a lot of those books because there are very few, well, there were very few diagram books in existence. And so for a while, ours were the only book. Now there's one other book that covers Advance and Challenge. But there are really today only 2 books that cover Advance and Challenge in diagrams. And one of them is mine. Now the lady, we've sort of gone out of business. She stopped printing the book. I've turned the books over to Palomino Square Dance Service.
Yeah.
And I've turned all my teach tapes and dance tapes over to them. So Palomino now really publishes and all my books and the tapes. And so I'm kind of out of that area of work right now.
Uh-huh. What about those tapes that have moving diagrams? These are videos, right?
Videos, they don't have moving diagrams. My one video was dancers, it was designed to teach mainstream dancers how to understand mainstream DBD, dance by definition, or all position dancing, but it took a different approach. Most, virtually all videotapes have a square dancing the calls and teaching the calls, and the caller will say, here's how you do coordinate, or here's how you do wheel and deal, and the square walks it through.
Right.
Mine was assuming the dancers knew how to do the calls already, and I would show them how to do it from different positions. So my one video was, well, that video, the mainstream video, was 90%, 95% walkthrough, and then just a little dancing at the end. And I should inject that for a number of years, I did have video teach tapes that did the same thing for advanced and C1, and I think we did C2 also. This was with a man in Ohio named Dale Garlock, and we recorded these tapes at his home and then sold those, and those were the only video teach tapes that were available, but they weren't of studio quality, and they quickly degenerated. The masters actually wore out, and we never had saved a duplicate master, and so we were just kind of out of business at that point.
Right.
We had a mainstream teach and a plus teach video, but they just wore out. We've never done any more with the videos just because the quality was so bad in terms of how the videos looked on the screen. They were okay when they were made, but after 10 years, the duplicating process just meant that we didn't feel right in selling them anymore because of the quality of appearance.
Right. Well, I've been asking everybody I talked with, do you have any regrets? Is there anything you wished you'd done differently?
Huh. Well, that's interesting. I guess I would say offhand, no. I can't think of anything I would have done. I can't think of anything I would have done differently. The only reason to have done something differently would have been if my circumstances had been different that
right.
would have forced me to do things differently. But it's all been kind of, the circumstances just kind of laid themselves out for me, and as each circumstance appeared, I just did what seemed obvious and logical at the time. So I guess I would have to say that there's nothing I regret not having done. I guess I would have done everything the same way that I did it.
Well, great. I'd like to talk a little bit about your personal life outside of square dancing today. You sent me quite an impressive list. You play softball, for example.
Yes, I'm in a senior softball league, and I play three times a week, spring, summer, and fall. I play tennis twice a week. I volunteer at a radio program for the blind and visually impaired in Pittsburgh, and I've been doing that for 11 years, and I've had a weekly program on holistic health for 11 years, and for 9 years I had a program on religious news and inspiration. I'm also on the pulpit supply committee of two Western Pennsylvania presbyteries, and so when a church has their pastor go on vacation and need a substitute person to preach, why I'm one person on the list that they can call on. So I don't have reverend in front of my name. I never went to seminary, but I'm on this list and get called. So I will lead church services about 15 times a year. I'm trying to think what else was on that list I sent you.
How about investing?
Oh yeah, a long-time interest of mine has been finances and investing, and so I help people who haven't studied it the way I have invest their money. At any given time, I probably have 10 people who I'm advising on how to handle their investments and how to have them be safe and this kind of thing. And the list of people range from people that have no money and are in debt to people who want to know how to handle a seven-figure portfolio. And so because I've studied this and with my background at the Wharton Business School and have studied this all my life, I've been able to help a number of people like this, which is very, very satisfying.
Well, that's great. And also you mentioned that you're a teacher of spiritual dance.
Right. Forgot that. Yes, I've been doing that for 15 years. Spiritual dance, I describe it as generally, if people know what Tai Chi is, which is very slow motions, standing pretty much in place, that's what spiritual dance is. It's slow motions in place, sometimes with a partner, sometimes in a circle. You can be moving in a circle very slowly. Oftentimes it's saying words in unison with the group or saying words to a partner for about 10 seconds, and then you move to another partner and do a few little hand motions and say words to them. And I've been doing that for 15 years. I've led spiritual dance in churches throughout the country, really from New England to Florida to California. And I try to find places where I can do spiritual dance in my travels when I'm square dancing.
Uh-huh.
Been fortunate to be able to find a number of places to do that. I've also done it, led spiritual dance at five different conventions where people get together for a spiritual weekend and have led spiritual dance there.
Well, that's great. I'd like to also ask you the same question I've been asking everybody else. Where do you think square dancing is going? And with you especially, where do you think challenge dancing is going?
Well, unfortunately, as we all know today, square dancing is going downhill. Some people blame the square dance activity, and oh, gee, they bemoan the fact that our product is just not the right product. We have to change. Well, the truth is, every group activity in this country has been on the decline since 1990, right? Since about 1990-91. Bowling used to be held up as the big example of how successful a group activity can be, and now bowling is down the drain. Church activities are down, are way reduced. Every group activity in this country is down. Lodge membership, whatever group you want to name. The reason for this is multifold. It started, first of all, with video cassettes, where people could stay at home for an evening's enjoyment. They didn't have to go out. It also started in the 80s with the fact that people to, quote, find themselves could do it individually. In the 70s, it was find yourselves by belonging to a group. But in the 80s, it was find yourself by doing something individual. Take a college course, go for a walk or jog. We have, at the end of the 80s and early 90s, all of a sudden we had working wives. In the 70s, wives tended not to work. Now everybody works. And so now the wives come home from work and they don't want to go out because they haven't been home. It used to be they were home all day and would say, well, I want to go out for the evening. Now they've been working all day, so they're content to stay home. The nail in the coffin of all group activities started about the mid-90s with the Internet. And now everybody sits home on the Internet, and that's really killed group activity. So as far as square dancing is just another group activity. And it's going downhill along with other group activities. Some of the changes that have been proposed for square dancing I think are good. We have to change with the times. If people don't like our dress code, why, fine, change it. And I approve and the changes in the dress code that we've made. But basically, I think our product is good. It's just that it's been affected by this mass downturn in group activity. I don't think square dancing will ever go away. I think it will always be there in terms of the one-night event for church groups and lodges and that kind of thing. And I think there will always be square dance clubs, but they may be different from what we have now. The emphasis today is on the community dance and clubs having knowing fewer calls and having maybe a club only knows 25 or 30 calls and not the 65 or 70 it takes now to graduate. But I think where that is that's a factor that will keep square dancing going. It will also may keep some people from belonging to square dance clubs because they'll say, well, I want more than that. So then we say, well, what does that do for advance and challenge? Well, advance and challenge will always be there, but it will, again, be a reflection of the total square dance picture. Advance and challenge has always been and will always be the very small part of the pyramid. It will never be the base. So as the base of square dancing declines, advance and challenge will decline. So in terms of where it will go, there will always be people that will be real gung-ho and want to learn a lot of calls, and so we'll always have some interest in challenge. We won't have the number of challenge clubs and advanced clubs in the future that we had back in the 90s and 80s, for instance. So I think square dancing, to summarize, I think square dancing will always be around, but I think it could be in another 10 years vastly different from where it is now. On the other hand, I remember 10 years ago people saying in 10 years from now it will be really reduced and really down, and those people would have been amazed to see how resilient square dancing has been. And the fact we do have a lot of clubs still going today, and we still have the national convention going, even though the numbers are way down. The national convention is a viable event still, where a number of people 10 years ago might have said that as of today it wouldn't be around any longer.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? What do you see for programs like the ABC program?
Well, the ABC program, you have to try everything.
Yes.
So people that want to try the ABC program, I say more power to them. It's so new, we just don't know how it's going to work. I think it's a fine idea on paper, but whether it will actually work or not, I don't know. The survey that Color Lab about 5 years ago hired a marketing firm to do research of people to see what people wanted in square dancing. Was the name square dancing good, and what do people want in square dancing? And one of the things that people said they wanted, or one of the questions was asked, was, would you support a square dance club? And the answer, yes, we will support it. And how often would you support it? Oh, we would support, we would go out to the club maybe once every 6 weeks or 2 months. Well, you can't support a club that way.
Right.
So, the, because there just aren't enough people there. So the ABC program is designed to, well, maybe we'll get these people that only want to come out once every 6 weeks or 2 months. Well, unless you're in a big population area, I don't think there's going to be enough people to support that. It's unfortunate. The idea of having a club just be there all the time and whenever people want to show up, fine. That's a great idea on paper, but in practicality, it doesn't fly. And I'm wondering, 5 years from now, will we see that while ABC was great on paper, will it actually have been able to be proven successful? And we won't know until that time happens.
Yes, right. One other question. Do you have any thoughts about contra dancing?
Love contra dancing.
Never get to do it,
but the beauty of contra dancing is the precise timing. I do one-night stands and call for church groups and that kind of thing. And I love the Virginia Reel and a couple other rounds and contras that I do there. And the timing is so perfect, and the dancers love it. And the joke in the challenge community is we ought to have challenge contras. And the contra dancers all throw up their hands and run screaming into the night when they hear that, because it's supposed to be real easy. But I've always loved the contra dancing at Collar Lab. Clark Baker, for the last couple years, has done a thing as an after party called Zesty Contra, which really could be almost considered a challenge.
Yes.
You know, not a challenge contra, but it's involved contra, and so I just love contra dancing and wish it was around more, and I would enjoy doing it. I don't have the time to start a group myself, and there's no contra group in my area, but I'm always been a big supporter of contra. I think it teaches people how to dance with the correct timing. I think all square dancers, it would behoove them to have 3 months of contra lessons, and if they never do it again, that's okay, but at least they've learned how to dance to the actual timing and dance to the music. Nobody dances to the music anymore. In fact, I've said for 15 years, we know our activity is no longer square dancing. Our activity is square walking.
Right.
And it's so rare now that I see people actually dancing to the music, that if I indeed see this, if I see one couple on the floor actually dancing to the music, I'll go down between the tips and compliment them. And if a whole club is dancing to the music, and there are about five or six clubs like that that I see during the year, I will compliment them over the mic at how impressed I am that they're dancing to the music. Now, they don't believe me. They think I'm just putting them on.
Right.
But they haven't been around the country and seen what I see, and I'm really serious when I tell them how wonderful it is to actually see a group dance to the music, because I'm hardly ever seeing this.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. I didn't think you would be involved with contras, but
I'm not involved, but I'm a big supporter of them.
Yes, right. Well, I know Clark, you're voicing Clark Baker's ideas too. Well, unless you can think of anything else, Ed, anything you want to put on this tape for posterity?
Well, I guess we've covered about.
Yeah.
I guess we've covered about everything that I can think of.
Have you ever had any hobbies?
Hobbies? When I was growing up in junior high and high school, I collected stamps.
Okay.
And then I quickly concluded that this was a con job by the federal government, because they kept printing more and more stamps just so the collectors would buy them and give the government the money.
Right.
So that wised me up right away, and I dropped that.
Right.
And now my hobbies are really these other non-square dance activities that we talked about, the tennis,
yes,
the softball, the radio station, the helping,
yeah,
people, investing, spirits of dance.
Right.
Those are my hobbies right now.
Right. So, well, I think we can call this a day. It's certainly been we've been talking for over an hour, and I'm really happy to get all this information on tape, and we'll get it transcribed, and I hope you'll look it up on the the Foundation of New England's website, sdfne.org.
Well, I appreciate all the work you've done over the years and on doing this. You've been doing this for over 10 years, I think, now.
Yeah, I started in 1996, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So I'm really impressed with all that you've done on this, and it's really, it's just wonderful that you've done this. A question, is there, are these tapes anywhere else besides the New England Foundation?
Well, there's a few at the Lloyd Shaw Foundation Archive. And outside of that, I'd say no, except what I happen to have here.
What I'm thinking would, I'm always a big believer in backup. And heaven forbid that the archives in New England would burn down.
Right.
But if it did, all your tapes are gone. And I would hope you might consider having them or somebody make a copy of the tapes, send them all to Caller Lab, and they can just store them in a box somewhere. But now we have two copies.
Yeah.
And I always like to have two copies of everything.
Right. Well, I know that they're making, Johnny Wedge is the one that's doing all the placing of these on the website, and I know he's making copies of everything on CD.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So, but I'll bring that up to the powers that be and make sure that it's certainly a wonderful suggestion. So, all right. Well, why don't we call it a day? And
I appreciate everything. And
I can't thank you enough for finally getting together. And I'm going to be talking with a couple other challenge callers, Vic Cedar.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Dillander.
Dillander. He runs Palomino, yeah.
Yeah. So
he's not a challenge caller. He may call C1, but his big claim to fame is that he runs Palomino.
Yeah, well,
which without Palomino, we'd all be down the drain.
Right. Well, that's what I want to talk to him about. Right. Okay. Well,
and if you think of anything else, feel free to give me a call and, or send me an email, and I can email anything back to you and that kind of thing.
There probably will be some corrections to make some of the names here and there. There usually is, and I'll get together with you by email for that.
Yeah, in case you wanted the spelling of when I said Pete Heckman, it's H-E-C-K-M-A-N.
Okay.
And other than that, well, it's easy on the spelling on Lazary and Kopman.
Yeah.
I don't think we had any other complicated names in there.
Okay. Very good. Well, once again, thank you so much, and it was really a pleasure to talk with you and say hello to Marilyn.
Okay,
and
very good.
We'll call this the end of the tape.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ed. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.